Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Classic FM. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, country, rock, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one, it was on this day back in 1979 that R&B singer James Brown did what? Was it A, he recorded a duet with Frank Sinatra? Was it B, he pounded the piano keys off an instrument during a concert? Was it C, he starred in the movie The Deer Hunter? Or was it D, he played at the Grand Ole Opry? So what did James I Feel Good Brown do on this day in 1979? And question number two, American composer Samuel Barber was born on this very day back in 1910. What was the name of his most famous composition? Was it A, Warsaw Concerto, B, Rhapsody in Blue, C, Grand Canyon Suite, or D, Adagio for Strings? Samuel Barber's most famous composition. What's its name, anyway? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of March the 8th. Well, it was on this very day back in 1714 that composer Carl Philipp Emanuel, CPE, Bach was born. His father, Johann Sebastian Bach. C.P.E. Bach was known for his Brandenburg Concertos, born today in 1714. Meanwhile, it was just 31 years ago today in the USA, 1993, that Beavis and Butthead premiered on MTV as a series. 1993, today. Loretta Lynn's Coal Miner's Daughter introduces our country music news. It's titled, Is Loretta Lynn's Granddaughter, Emmy Russell, on American Idol? This is published in AmericanSongwriter.com on the 2nd of March, 2024, by M. Casalina. Emily Russell blew fans away last week during her audition for American Idol's 22nd season. Russell, who is the granddaughter of country star Loretta Lynn, performed her original song, Skinny, to the panel of judges. In addition to her singing chops, she also showed off her ability to play the piano quite beautifully. Fans of the singer took to X to applaud her performance. Since Russell's audition was featured on last week's episode, it's likely we will not see her again so soon. Tonight's upcoming episode will likely feature a new round of auditions that we haven't seen yet. However, Russell absolutely nailed her audition and will be coming back again soon to complete and compete on the show. At this time, it's not clear when that will be or which upcoming episode she will return. Russell's appearance on American Idol is not her first foray into the music scene. She's already performed at the Grand Ole Opry and has quite a social media presence already. Idol doesn't usually feature talent that has already made their way into the music industry, so many fans of the show are curious as to why Russell chose to audition. During Russell's Idol audition, she told the judges that she wanted to challenge herself and her own voice by coming to the competition.
Because we were taught, I never thought of ever leaving. Put your holler. Well, a lot of things have changed since way back then. And it's so good to be back.
And in music research and technology, as we leave winter, our thoughts of course, turn to spring cleaning. This is an article titled, Four Ways That Music Can Help You Clean. It's published in supersavvyme.co.uk on the 2nd of March, 2024. There's nothing like listening to your favorite tunes while you whiz through your chore list. As Mrs. Hinch knows, here's how music can boost your positivity and productivity. Mrs. Hinch loves a cleaning playlist. In fact, she often jazzes up her Insta stories with a great tune. With all the extra cleaning needing at the moment, while everyone is at home, soundtracking it with your favorite songs should help to stop it feeling like an overwhelming and never-ending task. So next time you need to clean, why not pop on some music and crank the volume up? Here are just four reasons why it could make all the difference. Number one, it makes chores more fun. It's a rare person who looks forward to cleaning, but music could actually make it a part of your routine you enjoy, rather than dread. Obviously, you need to choose the right kind of music. There's no point in tuning into quote-unquote sad FM before you pop your marigolds on. Instead, look for upbeat songs that you can't help but dance around or sing along to. For inspiration, check out the ready-made cleaning playlists on your chosen music provider, with a number even dedicated to Mrs. Hinch herself, or create a playlist of your own favorite tunes. If you don't have young children around that you need to listen out for, try listening to the music through your earphones. This means it will come with you to every room of the house, and you will still be able to hear it over the sound of vacuuming. Number two, it helps you burn more calories. Housework is already a good calorie burner, averaging up to 200 calories per hour. But if you combine it with dancing and high-energy cleaning, you could easily double that. Plus, this means you can totally justify rewarding yourself with a cup of tea and a biscuit afterwards. Number three, music is scientifically proven to make you feel happier. When you listen to upbeat music, your brain releases the pleasure chemical dopamine. As well as making you feel happier, this chemical improves your motivation, meaning you'll want to carry on cleaning rather than giving up when you're midway through scrubbing the tub. And number four, it helps you get it done quickly. When cleaning, it can be easy to become distracted by, well, anything else. Something on the TV, your suddenly rumbling belly, your neighbor's cat in the garden. Listening to music can help focus your mind to the task at hand and motivate you to stick to it. Another good idea is to set a timer so you have a deadline to aim for to keep you on track, whether that's 15 minutes, 30 minutes, or an hour. You could also match your playlist to end around the same time as your cleaning routine should. So a happy spring cleaning, everyone. Fleetwood Mac's Albatross introduces our rock and pop music news. It's an article titled, How to Write a Fake Rock Song. The musician will butter on his new Broadway banger. This is written by Devon Ivy on the 27th of February, 2024 in Vulture.com. In 2013, playwright David Adjumi came up with the idea for Stereophonic, a show about a group of ego-clashing Fleetwood Mac-esque musicians working on their soon-to-be epochal rock album of the mid-70s. The play would need music, mostly bits and pieces of it as the band struggles to finish their own Rumors. A friend had suggested Adjumi reach out to Will Butler. He joined the project the following year. At the time, Butler was still a multi-instrumentalist in Arcade Fire. He left that group in 2021. He had never worked in theater before, but was drawn to the concept. He knew what it was like to be in a band, struggling to put out a single good song, and striving to find collective inspiration that didn't compromise his own creativity. 11 years later, Stereophonic is making its Broadway debut in April. In the fall, it received rapturous reviews during its off-Broadway run. It was one of our picks for Best Play of 2023, with special praise reserved for Butler's songwriting. The music in Stereophonic challenges the audience to both sympathize with and loathe each of the five band members, guitarist and vocalist Peter, bassist Reg, vocalist Diana, keyboardist and vocalist Holly, and drummer Simon, most of whom are entangled in thorny romantic relationships with one another. This tension comes to a head with the song Masquerade, a groovy stomper of a tune that the band agonizes over. It's the only full song heard in the play. First, the tempo is too slow. They finally nail it on take number 37. That song, Masquerade, is confirmation to the audience that the band indeed has the talent. So how does somebody create a fake classic rock song that actually sounds good? Well, number one, give it a timeless sound. I wanted Masquerade to feel transcendent. Other pieces of music do that in the play, but Masquerade is one of those where you feel why they're doing what they're doing. I wanted it to feel both like 1976 and the fact that 1977 is coming. I wanted it to be rooted in the time, but also I wanted to see Kurt Cobain listening to it in 1989. I wanted to see a 16-year-old me listening to it in 1998. I wanted it to have that timeless character like, oh, this feels like a Stayin' Alive era, but also feels like it could be today. Number two, root it in the text. Most of the music is reverse engineered from the script. These are people that listen to the White Album. The British people in the band were probably friends with people that were in the first draft of the Rolling Stones. They were playing 50s American blues music. It's not like, oh, let's see the albums that came out in 75 and let's try to copy that. I was trying to root it where they came from. Number three, find the right riff. One technical constraint on this song is that it had to be a riff. It was tricky to do. It's rooted in Peter because Peter's the guitar player. This guitar riff was something in his head that he couldn't stop. It's in his fingers and in his brain going over and over. Number four, pair it with some brooding lyrics. Lyrically, it's a medieval journey song. It starts with, "Got my ticket to the masquerade," which is kind of like Bayou Rock. It's like going on a pilgrimage to something you know is hollow, but that's the only place to be. You start there, and then you realize how lonely you are. The outro, "I'll see you when I get there," is really dark. You know, when the police sang, "Every breath you take, I'll be watching you," that seems so romantic, but you're like, huh? I guess the music made it that way, but that's dark. Number five, do it live. It only clicked into place when we heard the cast sing it. The second we had those three singers, it was like, oh, okay, this is a band. And finally, number six, throw it all away. Sometimes in a band you make something really awesome, but it's just missing something, or your brain can't comprehend that it's awesome. You cut it and it gets destroyed. Either way, it's not on the record. It made sense that they would record something so great and then be like, oh, but we already have a rocker on the record, and it's better than this one. So, how did you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was back on this day in 1979 that R&B singer James Brown did what? Was it A, he recorded a duet with Frank Sinatra? B, he pounded the piano keys off of an instrument during a concert? C, he starred in the movie The Deer Hunter? Or D, he played at the Grand Ole Opry? And the correct answer is, answer D, James I Feel Good Brown played at the Grand Ole Opry on this day back in 1979. As noted in the 3/5/24 Augusta Good News article titled "Ramblin' Roads," James Brown performed at the Grand Ole Opry 44 years ago, March the 10th. Nobody seemed to complain when Paul McCartney, the Pointer Sisters, Carol Channing, Anne Margaret, U.S. President Richard Nixon, or U.S. President Jimmy Carter's daughter, Amy, made guest appearances on the stage of the new Grand Ole Opry House in Nashville, Tennessee. But when it was announced that James Brown of Beech Island, South Carolina, planned to perform on the Opry on March the 10th, 1979, as the guest of country music legend Porter Wagoner, all hell pretty much broke loose, especially among several other Opry artists and fans who knew nothing about Brown's love of country music. The Opry had moved 5 years earlier from its longtime home of Ryman Auditorium with 2,362 seats in downtown Nashville to the 4,000-seat modern building just off Briley Parkway. So the management was looking at interesting ways to boost attendance. Opry cast member Del Wood was quoted as saying of Brown's invitation, "I could throw up." Opry member Justin Tubb, the son of Texas troubadour Ernest Tubb, said that if it was Ray Charles performing, he would be in the wings waiting to hug him when he came off the stage. Gene Shepherd, whose husband, Hawkshaw Hawkins, had been killed with Patsy Cline in the 1963 plane crash, said it was a slap in the face to those people who drive thousands of miles to see the Opry and have to be subjected to James Brown. Apparently, only Skeeter Davis, who usually sang her million-selling hit single, The End of the World, publicly supported Wagoner's decision to invite Brown. For 17 minutes, Brown went full out to entertain the packed audience with his trademark splits and microphone tosses. He was smart enough to include the traditional country songs "Your Cheatin' Heart," "Tennessee Waltz," and "Georgia on My Mind." But he also did a medley of his soul music classics "Cold Sweat," "Can't Stand It," and "Papa's Got a Brand New Bag." They treated me so nice. I felt I got as much praise as a white man who goes into a black church and puts $100 in the collection plate. I always have loved country music ever since I was a kid and listened to the radio in Augusta, he said. Country music really is just the white man's blues. My own daddy told me that I'd never make it by singing. I love Minnie Pearl, Brown additionally would tell me. We were on the Joey Bishop show together. I co-hosted the Mike Douglas show one time when Johnny Cash was a guest. Brown grew up watching the movies of Western singer and Grand Ole Opry star Tex Ritter. That made it even special when Ritter's son, Three's Company TV star John Ritter, heard Brown live over the WSM broadcast while driving in Nashville, turned his car around, and came to the Opry House to say hello. Summing up his Opry appearance, Brown said, I thought it was one of the best things I have ever done in my life. It was definitely a high point. And the answer to our second question, American composer Samuel Barber was born on this very day back in 1910. What was the name of his most famous composition? Was it A, Warsaw Concerto, B, Rhapsody in Blue, C, Grand Canyon Suite, or D, Adagio for Strings? Correct answer? Answer D, Adagio for Strings. As noted in a ClassicFM.com article titled Samuel Barber, A Life, following a series of blazing successes, the gifted and widely popular American composer Samuel Barber found himself gradually sidelined by the avant-garde. Samuel Barber had the misfortune to be the right man in the right place, but at the wrong time. His music is indisputably American in feel, albeit with a mild transatlantic flavor, yet it lacks the sheer pizzazz of those more inclined to embrace the popular mainstream. While Copland was busy evoking the sounds of the Old West in Rodeo and Billy the Kid, and Bernstein was devouring everything from boogie-woogie to rock and roll, Barber stuck to his guns with concertos, symphonies, and operas in the grand style. 50 years earlier, his gift for luxurious melody, poignant harmonies, and achingly nostalgic sound worlds would have made him a national hero. But by the 1960s, it was John Cage and Elvis who were grabbing the musical headlines. In his youth, fame and fortune came to Barber almost as easily as it had for Gershwin. Yet, unlike his colleague, he never felt entirely comfortable in the public eye and suffered periods of agonizing self-doubt and insecurity that increased with age. One can sense Barber's growing stylistic unease even in the glorious violin concerto, which for two movements is all Sibelius, but in the finale becomes startlingly brusque with an onrush a la Prokofiev. Indeed, it is the tension Barber creates between emotional warmth and restraint that lies at the heart of his musical output. Barber's prodigious gifts were evident from the start. In 1928, he won a Columbia University Prize for his violin sonata, and again in 1933 for his blazing orchestral overture, The School for Scandal. In 1935, Barber consolidated his earlier reputation with his symphony in one movement. The following spring, he rented a cottage at St. Wolfgang, just outside Salzburg, an idyllic setting that inspired his Opus 11 string quartet. The second movement was destined to become Barber's most celebrated work. It was arranged for string orchestra specifically at Arturo Toscanini's request and is now famously known as the Adagio for Strings. Struggling with depression exacerbated by alcoholism, Barber composed almost nothing for the next 6 years. Barber died a broken man. Overtaken by changing artistic trends, he unwittingly found himself consigned to the respected middle ground. With audiences clamoring for novelty, all Barber could offer them was honesty. As he revealed in a 1971 interview, "When I write an abstract piano sonata or concerto, I write what I feel. I believe this takes a certain courage." So, let's close out today's program with Samuel Barber's most famous composition, Adagio for Strings. Run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program is also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words: kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review, underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information, or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. So long, until next time.